Hello, I'm Ryan F9, and this is Suzuki's Whispering Death. Why is the RG500 called Whispering Death? And what makes it so dangerous? You cannot buy Max Verstappen's Formula One car. You cannot lease Marc Marquez's MotoGP bike and go hunting school zones of a Tuesday. But in 1985, Suzuki thought, why not? They take Barry Sheen's world-beating RG500 prototype and change its name to RG500 Production. That's it. The fasteners are changed from titanium to aluminum, and that's mechanically it. The road-going one, of course, gets a headlight, taillight, indicators, exhaust, baffled down to the legal volume, but still, your idiot son could save up $4,995 and buy very near a factory MotoGP racer. Makoto Suzuki says, the engine was 100% identical, we just changed the name. You could buy a production RG500 and win a GP, as Jack Middleberg did in 1981. That was the last time a privateer won a 500 GP. See, manufacturers compete on total equipment points. Whether it's piloted by Andrea Dovizioso or Andrea Bocelli, it doesn't matter. So making the factory racer publicly available is a power play. Suddenly, 14 of 24 grid entries want to be on Suzuki's. Makoto Suzuki explains, if your rider wins, you can only say the rider is world champion. If you win the Constructors' Championship, you can say Suzuki is world champion. And that works. They win 7 Constructors' Championships in a row at the cost of selling their soul to any devil. During the deadliest era of racing.
At the beginning, when you tried the first time the 500,
a little bit of fun together. Ed Gardner, the 1987 champ, rode at the Dutch TT, Pons on the first lap.
We can see why the two strokes are so violent here. They bang, then they intake and exhaust at once, to bang again. That is twice the power pulses of today's four strokes on tree rubber and bicycle brakes. What's worse is that this simultaneous porting loses some fresh intake right out of the exhaust. So what the Suzuki's race engineers do is take a green tea can, an actual green tea can, and weld it into the muffler. Now, when the engine goes bang, the sound of that bang travels faster than the power pulse itself, so it hits this widening, bounces back a low pressure wave to suck the nasty exhaust out. Then it hits this narrowing, bouncing back a high pressure wave right in time to lock the next charge in. It's an engine valved by its own music. But remember, the speed of sound in a given medium is constant. The green tea can is a constant size. So you end up with an engine whose airflow is valved for one specific RPM, the power band. Below the power band, the engine runs rich and makes fewer horses than a gelded stallion. Then suddenly, you get 200 horsepower per liter all at once when it's on the pipe, and the engine desperately wants to rev beyond that, but you mustn't let it, because then the green tea stoichiometry becomes too lean, and since two strokes rely on oily gas coming up to lubricate the cylinder, running lean means rubbing a dry piston until it welds itself solid, locks up, and kills you. If you think I'm just a 2020s catastrophizer, hear these quotes from hairy-chested 80s dudes. Suzuki himself says, the engine was very hard to ride and peaky. The power was produced from 8,000 to 10.5, that was it. I rode the RG500 for half a lap in Japan, and only once that was enough for me. On the straight, I opened the throttle, the rev suddenly appeared, the bike wheelied, and I pulled in. It was a terrible moment, says the guy who built the thing. Most two-stroke riders rode with one or two fingers over the clutch lever, waiting for a seize. I always had four. You never got much warning. You'd probably get a tenth of a second. Sometimes you could catch it, but it was the times you couldn't that were the trouble. I was flat on the tank towards Stavlo, doing like 180-odd into this long right-hander she seized, and I had no fucking chance. I went between the barriers and between this row of parked cars and out the other side into Stavelo Village. The two-strokes shattered my inner ears, but if you wanted to catch a seizure early, you needed to notice that slight tinkling noise just prior to a seizure, so I never wore cotton wool in my ears. Once you heard that pre-ignition noise, you knew the top of the piston crown was getting very, very hot, so the piston would start to swell, and that's when you got your seizure. Now that tinkling sound is gas combusting on contact with the top of a red-hot piston. That is the whispering death you had to listen for, because moments after, the piston would weld itself solid and send you skidding down the road. All this at your local Suzuki dealer for 0% down. And the whispering death has an even deadlier secret to share if we listen closely. See, this engine is surreptitiously four MZ125 cylinders stuck in a square, like a four-pack of Red Bull. Suzuki put the rotary valves on the left instead of the right, so people had to call it a mirror image rather than a carbon copy, but it's still a ripoff. A ripoff of the first bike to make 200 horsepower per liter, the MZ125. And that revelation piloted by Ernst Degner of Communist Germany. So how did Suzuki get it? Well, first Degner flies to Japan, and he doesn't wait in that long line for a SIM card. Who wants to waste more time after an intercontinental flight? So Degner pulls out his Soviet-issue iPhone 13 and installs the Saily app before ever leaving East Germany. Look, there's 160 countries of data plans to choose from, even some regional ones for cross-borders, backpackers and stuff. But Degner is in Japan on business, so he gets right to plugging in the code Fortnine, F-O-R-T-N-I-N-E, for 15% off the already penny-pinching rate. We're now at a fraction of the cost of roaming fees. I mean, just because you're about to sell Soviet state secrets to Suzuki doesn't mean you have to overpay for internet, am I right? And the app walks Degner through installing an eSIM. That's not hard, even for a 1960s chap. And if you download the app and use the code Fortnine at checkout, you too can get 15% off of a Saily eSIM. Click the link below if you're interested. It's because of sponsors like Saily that we can now afford to tell the real Ernst Degner story, which is actually even less believable. So, Degner rode the Whispering Death for standard worker's wages, comrade, 700 East German marks per month. He was earning the same as the guy grounding his pistons, while racers in the West lived like rock stars on 3 million a year. So the flag drops at the Swedish Grand Prix, and Degner ticks his RPM past the Whispering Death line, seizes MZ's engine, and retires. His boss said that Degner had by far the fastest bike in the class, but I reminded him not to go over 10,000 RPM because Ernst, I told him, the piston rings will fly away if you do. You know that. And this is his boss, Walter Cotton, talking. He came flying past close to the pit wall where we were standing, like the devil was after him. We tried to slow him down, but after two laps, he was not there anymore. Degner walked straight from his seized MZ and straight to Suzuki fixer Jimmy Matsumiya. Over whiskey and decadent Western jazz turned loud so the Stasi can't overhear, he offers to defect over the Berlin Wall with a suitcase full of those expansion chambers in exchange for 10 grand and a ride at Suzuki.
Karl Werkstatt, der ehemalige Motorenrennsportler und Betriebsangehörige des VEB Motorradswerk Zschopau Ernst Degner, ist zum Verräter an der Arbeiter- und Bauernmacht geworden. Degner, der jede nur denkbare Förderung und Unterstützung des Staates und der demokratischen Sportbewegung genoss und dadurch große Erfolge erzielen konnte, hat sich bei seinem letzten Start beim Motorrad-Weltmeisterschaftslauf in Schweden von kapitalistischen Konzernen kaufen lassen.
It's the most obvious case of industrial treason, and it ruins Degner's life. Remember, he still has to ride the Whispering Death that he sold to Suzuki. There was Ernst lying in this great ball of flame. All I could see were his boots sticking out. His face was bubbling. It was awful. It was horrible. Degner grows suspicious of every accident that befalls him. He was worried big time. He had a bodyguard with him the whole year, a private detective, if you like, and he had a gun on him. Wherever Ernst was, he was always there too. When the Whispering Death finally gets the last word, there's a rumor that Ernst dies with a slit throat and a note saying the Stasi never forgets. You can read it all in Matt Oxley's I Can't Believe It's Not Fiction, Stealing Speed, but never mind the shooting of one messenger. our RG500 still whispers of deaths in the thousands. When the Nazis start losing air superiority in World War II, they do two things. They establish a new concentration camp called Mittelbau-Dora, its purpose to provide slave labor for digging an underground research facility, and they call that lab Mittelwerk, where a bomb that can fly itself to Britain is engineered by Walter Cauden. That's right, Degner's future boss. Deja vu, eh? This is a pulse jet, and it's where expansion chamber technology was first born. It goes bang, and the sound of that pulse bounces back at low pressure to pull exhaust out, then again at high pressure to lock the next intake in. Valved by its own deadly music, it is deadly powerful at 1 RPM. ...250 Jews die each day Mittelwerk is marching their technology forward. It's more than was ever killed by the V1 buzz bombs. Now, how Walter Cauden felt about the atrocities that enabled his research, no one knows, but there's no doubt he knew.
Meanwhile, destruction of Germany's flying bomb sites goes forward. More and more of the so-called revenge weapons are being exploded in midair. Here are remarkable pictures of two robots that failed to accomplish their mission.
When the Allies win, they invoke the two articles of war crime. Individuals must be held accountable, and maybe not the smart ones, though. So Germany's rocket Nazis are whisked stateside to help NASA. Wernher von Braun famously asked Walter Cauden to join them. But the man who understands repercussions says no. He surrenders himself to be whisked to Camp 90 instead, where he's imprisoned for weeks, then released into communist Germany. Cauden writes of his new workshop at Motorrad Joppo, there were really only empty rooms, even light switches were missing. MZ has no dyno, the only way to test horsepower is to do a full bore run and time it. They have no lab, the only way to test stoichiometry is to do a plug chop. Again, you have to run the engine at full RPM, kill it, coast in, and then read the spark plug. It is dangerously underfunded work. Cauden even has to build his own oscilloscope so he can watch pressure waves amplifying horsepower in the expansion chamber. But he eventually optimizes the expansion chamber for two strokes, telling no one where the technology was first unearthed, but letting the world see the result, the MZ-125. The first naturally aspirated engine to make 200 horsepower per liter, whose plans were smuggled across the Berlin Wall in Degner's briefcase, all the way to Suzuki's garage, becoming the building block of this RG500 Square 4, powerful at 1 RPM, deadly at every other. The Whispering Death. Now, I've said everything that I have to say about the most dangerous motorcycle ever made, so I can just shut up, focus now.